This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
It's such an honor to present this next award.
And here are the nominees.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me.
I'm the king of the world.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
I am Katie Rich. I'm here with Richard Lawson.
Hello.
With David Canfield.
Hi.
And Rebecca Ford.
Hello.
On today's episode, we'll be talking about the raft of news about the upcoming Oscar ceremony, including who the hosts will be and whether or not they will require vaccines to attend. We'll answer some of your lingering questions about last week's nominations, including the hopes for movies like Flea and The Mitchells vs. the Machines. And at the end of the show, we will have a really exciting interview with Billie Eilish and Finneas, who are Oscar nominated for their song from No Time to Die. And they're interviewed by Sinead Burke, who is the founder of the organization Tilt the Lens and the host of the podcast As Me with Sinead. It's a really wonderful interview. So let's start with the big news of the week. We have Oscar hosts. They announced that Amy Schumer, Wanda Sykes, and Regina Hall will be hosting the Oscars together as a trio, following a bunch of rumors and then a report in Variety that broke a little bit early and maybe took some of the steam out of the Good Morning America announcement that was scheduled for Tuesday morning. Although, as I was saying, I like that they treated the announcement of the host as an event, even if the news broke early. Rebecca, you were on the news for us on Monday as Variety first reported it. How do you feel about it? How does this rollout seem to you?
I feel optimistic.
Yay!
I think it's an interesting trio. I'm a big fan of Regina Hall. I feel like every time I interview her, she's just so quick and smart and funny and charismatic that I think I'm really excited for. I feel like she's been a little bit underestimated. And so I'm really excited to see her take the stage. And then Wanda, I feel like, you know, I was watching this morning a piece of her guest hosting Jimmy Kimmel, and she's just so good and such a veteran that I think it's a really interesting group. I feel like Amy is the one that people are sort of most mixed about. I don't know how you guys feel, but I think they all bring sort of a different kind of comedy to the stage.
I feel like we were just talking about Regina Hall, maybe because of her Sundance movie, Richard, was like, I remember talking about Support the Girls into a microphone relatively recently. And again, like you were saying, Rebecca, like thinking about how great she is and how underestimated she is.
Yeah, she was in Master, and when the which is an interesting horror movie set in a college campus, and when the announcement was made that she was going to be one of the three hosts, I said, "Oh, is there synergy here? Is Master a Searchlight thing? Is this, you know, Disney ABC trying to really bring all their properties together?" Because Amy Schumer's on a Hulu show that's coming up, and no, it's Master's Amazon. So the Regina Hall choice feels that much more inspired or sort of out of left field. Maybe there's another project she's involved in that I'm not aware of, but. Yeah, I mean, in terms of the Amy Schumer doubt, I certainly saw a lot of that on Twitter, usually from people who are, you know, not to be listened to for the most part. But I hope my hope for her presence, you know, because it's going to be that like one, like they go kind of successively, right? I don't think it's going to be the three of them on stage the whole time, is that Amy opens the show with a kind of Gervais-esque skewering of people in the room and of the industry, because she's definitely capable of that. And then Wanda and Regina can do other things.
Yeah. I think Regina, because Regina was the one that popped out as most surprising to me.
just because the other two were more seasoned comedians who have more experience, I think, hosting. But Regina yeah. Hall was in Girls Trip, which I think Will Packer produced. Mm-hmm. So they did have a connection there. And I totally agree with both of you, though, that she seems like a perfect kind of tone for the show. And I think having two comedians and having her energy kind of mix it up a little bit, it'll be really interesting. Like, I'm really excited for all three of them. And I think for my enjoyment of the show, it's a really good group of hosts. But it does feel a little bit like, I don't want to say underwhelming, but, you know, there was so much talk about, you know, what big star are they going to bring out to host and bring all the viewers back? And what's this group going to be? Because there was that meme going around when the 3X structure was first announced. And it does feel slightly random and grab baggy. And I don't know that's necessarily a bad thing, but I don't think that they should expect it to move the ratings needle at all.
Yeah, I think the star thing is such a double-edged sword, and that's why they've yeah. been having such a hard time getting people to do it. And, like, why having the trio, I think, is helpful. Like, you can imagine all three of these people being like, I don't want to do this on my own. Like, I don't want to bear the blame. But as a group, they can kind of spread it out a little bit. And I, you know, all the Oscar Wikipedia pages, whoever is updating them, God bless them, they're so detailed. And there's a page for all the previous hosts. And in the 70s, they really went deep on groups of people and just, like, wildly different groups of people. Like in 1973, it was Carol Burnett, Michael Caine, Charlton Heston, and Rock Hudson.
Oh, wow.
And then in 1974, it was John Huston, Burt Reynolds, David Niven, and Diana Ross. So I mean, first of all, I need to find clips of this and see what it looked like. But just the idea of like a power group and kind of using the dynamics of the different people to bounce off of each other. Like even when we've had multiple people hosting, like Steve Martin and Alec Baldwin or notoriously James Franco and Anne Hathaway, there hasn't been like a dynamic among them. Mm-hmm. And even if these three are not on stage together, I think the differences that they will bring to the stage could add a lot.
I think, though, Katie, you should mention that it was the 70s, so it was kind of an orgy sex party vibe up there with the multiple hosts.
Well, there's no guaranteeing that these three won't bring that as well.
Right. Do you think there's any deliberate symmetry with the fact that Regina King opened the last ceremony and now Regina Hall is just a sort of honoring of the Reginas, the Regini?
It would be cool if Regina King came back for a cameo again this year to like hand it off to the next Regina.
Yeah, with another beautiful tracking shot.
Yeah, and then Regina Spektor hosts next year and we continue. Exactly.
And of course, the first hostless Oscars of this era, Regina King's win was what opened that show. So it is like, because Amy, Tina, and Maya gave her the first award of that night. So it's Regina's all the time, I guess. So I guess we should be expecting Regina Hall to open.
good memory. This has been a big week for just little tidbits of Oscar news. And kind of hours before the news started breaking about the hosts, the Academy themselves announced their plan for, it's not the Twitter Oscar. I'm going to look up what it's really called, but it really just feels like the Twitter
hashtag
Oscar.
Hashtag Oscars fan favorite.
Fan favorite, yeah.
And then hashtag cheer moment. Is that so there's a lot going on. David, you wrote about this one for us. And there's a wide range of skepticism to be brought to it, but as Oscar fans, I feel like we're required to have a little faith in this. So, what are we expecting from this this social media geared part of the Oscars this year?
To be honest, I'm not entirely sure what the plan is here. I kind of perused the hashtags a little bit, and it was a really dark place. So I don't recommend anybody do that. If you have like people you like in your feed tweeting them out, that's great. But I wouldn't like look to see what people are saying, because there's
How much of it is furious Spider-Man fans?
There's Spider-Man fury, and then there's satire Spider-Man fury, and it just kind of all blends together in this fairly nightmarish.
Yeah.
But like, that is, I think, the point of this award is to get Spider-Man a moment at the Oscars. And I, from my early sampling, it looks like that's going to happen one way or another. Yeah, I think that the plan right now is for, they have a way of voting on Twitter. They also have a form you can do on the Academy website that's pretty easy. You vote for your favorite movie, they tabulate it, and then the most voted film will get a moment on stage announced by three voters randomly selected who are flown out for an all-expenses-paid trip to the Oscars.
Now, having looked through all of these tweets, is it going to be random, or are they going to find people who do not seem like lunatics who are voting in this?
Well, they're also allowing people to vote 20 times a day and I don't want to call those people the lunatics, but there's certainly like there's a skewing toward the most passionate of Oscar's fan favorite voters. So I don't really yes. know what that means. but some group who very eagerly participated in this campaign will be there on Oscars night in an attempt to bring the normies back to the Academy stage.
It's going
to
be Kevin Smith in disguise.
And Jimmy Kimmel. Yeah.
Don't underestimate the power of the Gaga army, though. Like, it could just be House of Gucci. Just
very true. That's a great point.
I'm expecting BTS's most recent music video to win this prize. I don't know what you guys are talking about.
No, those people are the most powerful ones on the internet. Oh, yeah. That's true.
And the winner is Come to Brazil? Like,
Richard and Rebecca, how much are you expecting this to be chaos, and how much does it feel like the Academy just like once again bending over backwards to try to get people to like really engage in the show?
I feel like it's going to be anticlimactic during the actual show because it's not an actual Oscar, so they don't get an actual statue. And so I feel like it's just going to be someone being like, and the fan favorite Oscar movie is Spider-Man, and then we move on. I just don't know how they make it feel like a real moment, unless, you know, Tom Holland's going to come out and dance or something.
Which he should.
I'm still very much in favor of that. but I'm not sure how it's going to play out to feel significant.
I was debating this with a friend yesterday, and, you know, because we sort of all on this podcast and could just straddle both worlds where we're fans, but we're also critics, and we're also kind of hoping the Academy and the Academy Awards can be their best self. But like, none of us really know what that is because the industry has changed so much. Viewership has changed so much that like, but I did see a lot of sort of self-appointed Oscar purists or whatever rolling their eyes at this announcement. And I get it because it does seem a bit slapdash and, you know, sort of obviously prone to manipulation or grievous error, you know. But like, the fact of the matter is, if more people don't watch this, the show is going to slowly die. And so any effort made, whether it's a cheesy Twitter poll or whatever, to bring in and engage younger audiences, newer audiences, people who don't pay attention to this normally, I think, at least from my perspective, I kind of have to welcome, at least as an interesting experiment. I don't know that nominating Far From Home or No Way Home, rather, for Best Picture would have done the same thing. I kind of doubt it. I think it's more about stunts and casts and, you know, like and having actors presenting things or having Beyonce and Billie Eilish perform and advertising that starting yesterday. You know, I don't mind all the flashy embellishment because what's at the core of it is something that I like and value as much as other people like and value the Super Bowl, which has its own myriad problems. And I recognize that the Oscars are by no means perfect, but I think it's worth trying to save and give a little bit of a shine back to. And if this is the kind of thing that it requires, then so be it.
Yeah, I mean, if getting Drive My Car a Best Picture nomination then requires the Academy to give a weird semi-Oscar to Spider-Man, like, that's a worthy trade-off, right?
I think it's...
Yeah, and to the extent that I've kind of radicalized and I'm like, they should have just given them the nomination. Like why not? What do you lose?
The Spider fans have gotten to you.
Like, but what do they lose, really? You know, like, integrity, yeah. But no one knows who voted for what. Maybe we could just all assume that, like, the visual effects branch is so powerful that they got a Best Picture nomination for Spider-Man, you know? I'm not suggesting that the Academy manipulate the results, but, like... What is the point of being stalwart about it when that position keeps losing ground, I guess?
Yeah.
I think it's pretty stupid and pretty harmless what they're doing. I just don't, it doesn't bother me. I think that I remember when the popular film Oscar was announced and very briefly lived on as a proposal for the actual Academy to vote on, that I found way more offensive and potentially damaging to an Oscar's credibility because you had actual Academy members like doing this weird rivaling award to Best Picture that kind of undermined everything. Like, nobody won in that scenario. Whereas with this one, I mean, the Academy votes for what it votes for. I think they voted for, in my opinion, a not great, wildly popular movie in Don't Look Up. They are capable of doing that. They did not vote for Spider-Man. So, you know, if this is a consolation for the their own tastes and how they don't align maybe with general moviegoers completely, then that's fine with me. I don't think it's going to impact the show significantly.
Yeah, that's been the maddening thing about this last round of like, well, why couldn't they nominate the popular movies? Like Jimmy Kimmel got in on this, former Oscar host, and Spider-Man being kind of the cudgel they were beating the Academy with, when like Dune and Don't Look Up are both like objectively, visibly popular. And right. there's this huge range of titles that are in there. Power of the Dog is popular by, mm-hmm. you know, whatever Netflix metrics we have access to. It gets better than last year when nobody was seeing anything. And maybe the ratings will be better as a result, but it's the questioning what the actual awards themselves are for is much more infuriating than like, let's figure out how the show should look and get people to tune in.
Right. It's the adornment around it that I think they need to add. And maybe this is part of that, you know, and I want every award televised, but like, if you need to stretch that show into longer than 4 hours just to get that kind of Grammys-esque, like you watch the performances, you watch the stunts, you don't, you, like the awards are nice, you know, add-ons, but like, I don't know. I'm sort of increasingly okay with rethinking the scope and focus of the show to some extent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's not like the nominated movies don't have their moment. You know, the speeches are still going to get televised. So then if you give over more time to like a star-studded We Don't Talk About Bruno, like, you know, performance on stage, like that balance is still there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's my personal hope, by the way. I just want Andrew Garfield and Tom Holland and God knows who else singing on stage.
And if anything, the choice of hosts, which was also, you know, unofficially announced the same day as this, proves to me that the investment really is in making a funny, good show as well as they can. And that was yeah. reassuring to me. The choice of the hosts is like defiantly not pandery.
What would have felt pandering?
Well, someone who they know will bring in a more general audience. I don't know that any of these comedians necessarily, or actors in Regina Hall's case, necessarily bring in that kind of broad general audience that's very far away from the Oscars that they're trying to lure in. I think that people who are excited for the Oscars are probably excited for this group of hosts. I am. But I don't know that that is going to translate to the very wide viewership they're trying to capture. So to me, it just seemed like an affirmation that they're going to try to do a fun show. And whoever watches will enjoy it.
But next year, they should really have the Hype House host it.
Well, let's go back to the first Oscar ceremony controversy that we were all talking about before all this came up. And maybe that was all part of the plan. But last week, it broke in The Hollywood Reporter that they will not be requiring vaccines to attend the Oscars. They're requiring PCR tests, I believe, within some amount of time. The rules around this are unclear, since as far as we all know, like Los Angeles County requires vaccines for indoor events. And I don't know if anyone has any clarity on how that's going to go. David, you and Rebecca and I were talking to some reps last week and got kind of just a series of astonishment that it was happening and expectation that we'd walk back. Do we still think that they're going to have to go back on this or figure something out to make people feel comfortable going to the Oscars?
I do think they're going to walk it back. I think this is going to be a popular Oscar switcheroo eventually because, you know, I was talking to several reps right after this was announced, and one of them was saying he was on the phone with a bunch of studio execs when this news broke, and they all were just like, you've got to be kidding me. Like, this is not happening. Like, just as you were saying, complete shock. And, you know, I think we're recovering from this last surge. And yes, LA is definitely opening up again, but it seems a far leap to, you know, sort of be fine with not requiring that one basic standard for such a massive event.
There was also an interesting, which is another reason why I agree with Rebecca that they're going to walk it back, because it did present an interesting investigative element in that the SAG Awards are requiring it. So you could look at who went to the SAGs and then who didn't go to the Oscars and be like, well, that person's not vaccinated, you know, or reverse the other way around. I mean, didn't go to the SAGs, did go to the Oscars. And I don't think anyone, publicist or talent or anybody, wants the Oscars to be viewed as a way to find out who's not vaccinated, you know?
Yeah.
So I feel like they're going to have to cut their losses and then blame a lot of no-shows on scheduling or whatever else.
I mean, Rebecca and I are about to hit the trail for a solid month of really wall-to-wall events, and everyone's coming back out. And a lot of these events, if I believe all of them, except for the Oscars, require proof of vaccination in addition to testing. And to your point, Richard, that will make it even clearer who is not participating in these things, who suddenly shows up at the Oscars. I just don't see how you would get around that if you were repping someone and you didn't want that out. It just feels, in addition to not being safe and feeling like you're moving toward the wrong side of this, you know, divide in Hollywood, which we know there is one. It's also just feels kind of dumb in terms of the way that people are going to be outed.
Yeah.
Well, it's just a reminder that the Academy and sometimes the industry at large is really not cognizant enough of how the internet functions. It's like the minute that that gets announced, the first and only thing people are going to do is start speculating about who, and particularly who they made that decision to accommodate, you know? Mm-hmm. And like that the Academy was like, oh, no, it's just that we're kind of like doing things differently. It's like, no, this is proof. This is exactly an incitement for people to start conspiracy theorizing. I just feel like this was really boneheaded and proof yet again that not enough attention is being paid to like how the dissemination of information has radically changed in the last few years.
I do think this news probably leaked before they were ready to tell anyone it, though. It does sound like, you know, this wasn't something the Academy announced. But I mean, to me, the whole frustration about this is that I don't have total faith that these other events are even going to not make exceptions for certain people. I mean, David and I went to Telluride, and that was supposed to be an all vax event. And from what we've heard, there was talent there that wasn't vaccinated. And I don't know what kind of medical exemption they may be able to get. But to me, I'm like not totally sure that these events aren't going to make those sorts of exceptions for big names as well. It's just sort of the world of privilege that, you know, these events happen in. So I just don't know what, you know, I don't have any faith that any of these events is full of completely vaccinated people.
Yeah, that's probably the realistic.
Yeah. But don't you imagine for the Oscars, it only takes like two or three like huge celebrities who are maybe likely to win to say, I'm not coming if you don't require vaccines for them to reverse course?
I think it does. Yeah. And I think that's going to happen. You have a wide age range of nominees here and people who would be, I think, at serious risk. I think we know enough about the difference between vaccinated and unvaccinated people in terms of the risk they pose, where people aren't not everyone's going to feel safe going or feel like it's worth it. And that should easily be enough for the Academy to switch course.
Yeah.
But I do agree.
Anthony Hopkins needs to just say, hell no. We all know he's vaccinated. We saw he got vaccinated on camera. And I don't want him there if he's not safe. He's too valuable.
And to Richard's point, in regard to Anthony Hopkins, the Hollywood Reporter piece did a service by kind of previewing what will happen in terms of the speculation, because one detail in that piece was that at least one of the four acting Oscar winners of last year is not vaccinated. And obviously they almost always bring all four out to present to this year's class. So, and there was huge speculation immediately about which person it was. I think most people have a solid guess. but if you open that up, then it's just going to be chaos.
Yep. Hopefully by the time this comes out, they reverse course and we we don't need to further discuss, but maybe that will be next week's topic too.
I'm Chris Murphy.
I'm Richard Lawson.
And I'm Hilary Busis. We are from Vanity Fair's Still Watching podcast. Next up, we're watching the new HBO show, The Regime.
Madam Chancellor, let's keep the gloves on.
This is not a confrontation. We're just saying what's true.
Academy Award winner Kate Winslet is our chancellor as she leads a faux European autocracy in turmoil.
We'll be watching week by week as The Regime unravels.
And we'll be talking to the stars along the way.
New episodes of Still Watching will drop every Sunday after The Regime airs.
We want to talk some more about this year's nominees, but first, a brief pause and a look toward the future. I could not resist the chance to talk about the teaser trailer for Deepwater that dropped this week. It's going to be premiering on Hulu right before the Oscars. I think it's March 17th. It is the Ana de Armas, Ben Affleck movie that got kind of perpetually delayed by the pandemic, and then they broke up, and then who knew if it was ever going to come out? It's going straight to Hulu, which is, you know, maybe not the best show of the studio's faith in it. You know, it's owned by Disney now, which is very strange. And it was just basically 1 minute long teaser of sort of sex happening somewhere. It's hard to know exactly what's going on in this scene, but I was fascinated by it. I'm fascinated by the fact that it came out right after the opening weekend of Marry Me, Jennifer Lopez's new vehicle. It's so complicated, but I cannot be the only one of us who is just really excited to see whatever this movie is going to be.
I'm just heartbroken. Oh. This is not happening in the midst of a Ben Affleck Oscar campaign.
I think it's only happening because there is no Ben Affleck Oscar campaign.
Well, they put the date. I remember when they dated it originally for March. And he was always kind of a long shot for a nomination, but he was somewhat in that mix. He got the SAG Award nomination. And I remember thinking, if this movie comes out like at the height of Oscar campaigning for Ben Affleck, it was like a weird show of faith that he will not be nominated. That was how I took it. And I suppose that is borne out.
What you're missing, Katie, is that minute scene. That is exactly how John Huston and David Niven opened the 74 Oscars.
Weirdly, they were outside under a tree.
Yeah, it was beautiful.
Very experimental. But
the trailer's cool. I mean, I like that it's kind of elusive and you don't really know what's happening or what the rest of the movie is. And it's a lot more artful than I thought, having read about this movie that, you know, kept getting punted to different dates and now to streaming. And, you know, it seemed like it was a big disaster. There have been rumors on the wind, or maybe more than rumors, that like Affleck and De Armas like hate it and want to distance themselves from it, not just because they would have to do press together conceivably, but I don't know, this first teaser, whatever it is, really got me. I was already pretty invested, but like now even more, like actually daring to hope that it's a interestingly made movie.
Same.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are going to tune in the minute it hits Hulu, and at least I am. And all of us clearly are. So I think it's a really smart move, and I feel like the marketing is going to play to our sort of obsession with Affleck and his love life. So. Yeah, I'm excited for it.
Okay, back to this Oscar season. We have some of your questions from last week's nominations that we wanted to get into. And then further news, which was two streaming dates for possibly the last remaining Best Picture nominees that aren't streaming already. You guys can correct me on that. Drive My Car is going to premiere on HBO Max, which is an exciting deal. It's a Janus Films release, so it didn't have an automatic streaming home that it would have gone to. And that seems like a good home, which we can talk about. And then on the same day, on March 2nd, West Side Story will finally show up on Disney Plus. I think this is only a good thing for getting more people to watch both of these movies. Does anyone have anything to add other than hooray, everyone watch them?
Great timing. Licorice Pizza is the only one now that is yet to hit streaming, I believe.
Yes.
As my family members keep reminding me and asking me, when is it hitting streaming? And I don't have an answer. But yes, I think that first of all, I was so just thrilled that Drive My Car got this deal, is going to have that kind of exposure. It's had such an incredible run theatrically for this season, where movies of its stripe mostly didn't fare very well. And just the life it had, even before the nominations and now continuing after. So it feels like a really serendipitous way for that campaign to sort of wind down, to get onto streaming and get those eyeballs for people who didn't feel comfortable going to the theater. And I know many of those people who are really excited to see it who haven't yet. And then for West Side Story, I think it's the same kind of case. It's two movies that are missing a certain chunk of an audience that now will get to find those eyeballs. So it's very exciting.
I think West Side Story will have not even really a second life, but kind of its first real life on Disney Plus. Like,
yeah,
I think that movie is going to be huge there. At least I hope it is. But because I think, you know, whether it's younger people who stan Rachel Zegler on Twitter but didn't get a chance to see it in theaters for a variety of reasons, or did get to go see it in theaters but want to watch it over and over again for the rest of their lives, like, there it is for in perpetuity, conceivably. And then all the looky-loos who didn't, you know, who were curious about it, but weren't curious enough to see it in the theaters. Like, I don't know. I just think that it's really good news for West Side Story. Drive My Car, the 3-hour not in English hurdle for American audiences will, I think, you know, a lot of American audiences anyway, will be a hurdle forever. But I'm really glad that that's one, because, you know, I keep hearing anecdotally from friends, family, like, oh, I really want to see that. It's not playing anywhere. I can't find it. When is it going to be on demand? And now I actually, kind of like your family with Licorice Pizza, David, like, I can point them to that and say, here you go. And just a few weeks before the Oscars, maybe that will be another little thing in addition to Twitter polls or whatever that helps, you know, eyeballs move toward the show.
Yeah, I feel like I would bring up make myself feel old all the time, just thinking about myself as like a teenager, like being obsessed with the Oscars and having no access to like Il Postino. And if it had been like in my house weeks before the Oscars, I would have been so excited. So I hope that there are enough people out there who really want to sit down with 3 hours to drive my car and know that it's worth it for them. And I'm just so thrilled they've made it so accessible.
I do really like the image of you, Katie, as what, a teenager barely watching Il Postino.
Oh, yeah. Which I've still never seen. Maybe maybe it's on HBO Max and I should watch it right now. Yeah.
Probably the service if it's on one.
Exactly. Okay, to dive into a few of your remaining listener questions from the nominations, starting with kind of a downer one, and then maybe we'll get to some happier ones. We had Frank write in, is Flea going to lose three times? I don't see how it'll beat Summer of Soul, Encanto, or Drive My Car. That would be its nominations in the documentary category, the animated category, and the international feature category. I'm afraid that's probably right, but you know, as much as I would like Flea to win an award, I feel like its nominations were still the reward for it. Any of you guys think maybe it stands a chance somewhere?
Man, that is a bummer.
Yeah.
I feel like documentary is maybe the best chance for it. But I think you're right. There are clear front runners, or I think this listener is right, that there are clear front runners in each group. I mean, it's already made history by being nominated in all three categories, and obviously it has been really, really warmly received by voters and viewers in general. So I feel like it's already won in some sense, but I would love for it to somehow surprise and win in one of those categories.
We got to get it. Hashtag cheer moment. Okay.
Sarah, if, you know, that's it. That's how we do it.
I don't want to spoil, but I think we all know what moment that is. But
yeah.
It's like really the only point in the movie where you can cheer.
They find that cute cat outside their house early on. I cheered for that cat.
That's true. Okay. Fair. Maybe there too.
Tweet it, Katie. Tweet it.
Tweet the cat. I think it could beat Summer of Soul.
Me too.
I think that just anecdotally talking to people, not necessarily who are Academy voters, but people in the industry who appreciate what Questlove did with that film. And it's, you know, for a lot of people, it's the first time they're hearing about this concert. And the archival footage is incredible. But I think a lot of the people I've spoken to have been like, but it's kind of just a concert film with some talking head interviews, and that they don't necessarily see more elevated artistry beyond that. I mean, it's certainly a huge undertaking, but, and it's a really compelling movie, but I think maybe Flea, with all of its added components, animation, this really arresting first person account, like the timeliness of the, you know, Afghan refugee crisis then and now, I think that Flea has a shot there.
Have we all forgotten my octopus teacher? I mean, this yeah, category does not go as we expect. And I think to the argument that Flea can win here, My Octopus Teacher in part one, just because it pulled on heartstrings more, and I think people responded to it in a more gut way, even though it was not the most formally interesting documentary of that group. And I think Flea does have that advantage over Summer of Soul, that it's much more of an emotional experience. It's more affecting in a lot of ways. And I totally agree with Richard. I think that's where it can win. And I honestly think it has a really strong chance there, even if Summer of Soul is the default frontrunner. Flea also hit, iTunes and all those on-demand platforms not too long ago. So it could peak with a certain audience as well at just the right time. So
both would be great, worthy winners.
So, absolutely.
Yeah, that's the good thing.
But it's not beating Encanto or Drive My Car.
Let's go to another movie that a listener is rooting for. Louisa writes in, would love to hear your thoughts on animated feature, speaking of Flea. With two Disney and one Pixar title, does Mitchell's versus the Machine stand any chance? I would say yeah. I think Encanto is probably a strong contender for first place, but I think that there's a lot of other strong nominees in there, Flea included. Are you guys hardcore on Encanto? Do you think Mitchell's can sneak in there?
I'm pretty hardcore on Encanto.
Me too.
I think Mitchell's has a lot of love. They have been sending out promo swag for that for what feels like a year practically.
Yes.
you know, there's a huge push behind it because it's Netflix, but that also could be a mark against it. And Mitchell's is really sweet and it feels different in certain ways. Encanto, while lovely in a way, like it follows a similar Pixar-y pattern that maybe people are tiring of. I don't know. I think the one thing that Mitchell's doesn't have is a number one song in America situation, which Encanto does.
Sure.
And also the Lin-Manuel Miranda factor, which is, you know, popping up in other places in the Oscars. And he's definitely an industry favorite. So slight edge to Encanto, but Mitchell's would probably be number two, would be my guess.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the year that Spider-Verse, which I think is the closest comparison to Mitchell's here, won, it was a Pixar sequel, Incredibles 2, which I don't think really had all that much affection, and a Disney sequel, Ralph Breaks the Internet. And I think that kind of cleared the path for it a little bit more with whatever sequel snobbery that the Academy still has. But I love Mitchell so much that I'll be happy just to see them. Katie Mitchell, the character in the movie, is going to be so excited to go to the Oscars. So if you're invested the way that I am. Okay, one last listener question. And this one, another kind of a bummer from Tyler. Is it going to be Oscars so white for the rest of time? Just feels like all the changes made within the Academy in the last few years are not really moving the needle forward. The international presence is notable, but the lack of Black and POC actors and director noms is still so striking. It's just really disappointing as a Black viewer to feel like we are on a hamster wheel with this conversation. I understand institutional change is slow, but also, like Richard Lawson always has said in the past, this stuff is all made up. It is a bummer to see it this way. And Richard, this is actually in a piece that you are working on, they'll be coming out later, kind of pointed out that the international bent of the Academy hasn't extended to acting categories yet at all. As you know, noteworthy with Drive My Car not getting any acting nominations, same with Parasite. So Richard, from your perspective, like, does it seem like the international bent is just not getting at the acting representation as quickly as we would like?
Well, yeah, because that issue needs to be resolved from many approaches, but let's say two major ones. One that does really have to explicitly do with a more broader inclusive academy itself, which would be, let's look at something like Lingui, The Sacred Bonds, or Atlantics a couple years ago, full of great performances, or at least one big central towering performance, and bring those into the mix, you know, because there are plenty of performances by actors, you know, people of color from all over the world that merit, you know, inclusion. Drive My Car is a great example. There's two really, really great performances in that movie. Parasite is another example recently. So that can be fixed institutionally within the Academy, because the Hollywood industry really doesn't have any effect on those movies being made. They exist. The other thing more pertinent to like the local, you know, ness of the Academy and the broader industry is that they just need to be making more movies that are more inclusive and that are pitched in that sort of awardsy timber, you know. It's great to have a movie like Get Out or Black Panther recognized, but those are ultimately genre films that are treated as outliers. And I think that maybe they need to become more inclusive of genre, or there just need to be more movies in the vein of a Nomadland or whatever else that aren't just centering white characters and white actors. So part of it is something the Academy can do, but unfortunately, a lot of it is these nominations are results of a larger problem.
I feel like Rebecca and I talked about this back in Telluride, that it was again looking like, you know, you had King Richard and it had to carry so much of that weight this season because there just weren't a lot of other films featuring a Black cast that were going to contend. It was a big disappointment that Ruth Negga wasn't nominated for Passing, or that that movie didn't really go anywhere with the Academy. But otherwise, you know, you have Denzel Washington nominated here, Ariana DeBose, and the King Richard stars. And then beyond that, there wasn't, the Academy could have definitely recognized the actors from Drive My Car. But in terms of, to your point, Richard, American films and productions and actors to recognize, the industry just did not meet the moment in any way. And it felt like a really significant, to me at least, backslide, even if the nominations aren't completely white as they were in those few years, in terms of what the industry had to offer and what voters had to choose from, it felt like a really bleak slate, honestly.
Yeah, I think we lost a lot when In the Heights also wasn't part of the conversation, because I think that would have been really exciting for Latinx representation. But, you know, as Richard put it so well, it's a systemic problem about who gets to tell the stories and who gets these studios supporting their stories with the kind of financial backing that an awards season needs. So it's frustrating to say it's about patience, because I think we're all sort of fed up with waiting for this sort of change. But, you know, we just have to hope that the gatekeepers are just, A, becoming more diverse themselves, and sort of supporting storytellers that wouldn't have had these opportunities before.
And I also think, you know, to kind of amend what I said, like, it is about making more movies starring and about people of color that would fit the traditional Academy bill, but also expanding what that tradition is. Mm-hmm. You know, you look at something like Westerns have historically done well at the Academy. So where is The Harder They Fall? I know that The Harder They Fall has more of a comic, violent bent to it than did Unforgiven, which was more of a sort of slow burn drama with some shoot 'em ups within it, you know, but like, The Harder They Fall is chock full of excellent performances. I would say RJ Seiler for supporting actor would have been a great, cool choice. Mm-hmm. You know, so there needs to be more just in general, whether it's top prestige, Oscar bait, all the way down to genre, and they can meet in the middle somewhere. The Academy can start recognizing, you know, genre stuff and, you know, what all that. So it's a huge problem. And I understand this listener's frustration and all of the frustrations about it. We share that frustration, but it's unfortunately not quite as simple as changing the makeup of the Academy, because they still can only interact with, to some extent, at least in the American side of things, the supply that they're given.
It makes me think, too, bring it all the way back to the beginning, like the powerful lead performance in an indie movie that can be driven, Regina Hall in Support the Girls. Like, mm-hmm. that's the kind of movie that, like, like many white actresses have ridden to Oscar success, and has happened far less often for actresses of color.
And I would hope that if it's a hit on Amazon, that Regina Hall in Master could be in awards conversations next year, because she is great throughout, has one really towering scene that would play as a, you know, the sort of nominee clip and play very well, you know, and I know that it's a small streaming horror film that's premiering in March, but, you know, so a year before the next year's Oscars. But for the time being, until this stuff is literally put in, you know, older, stuffier Academy members' laps, like, go seek out other things that are already there. And there's plenty in that number, certainly.
Well, it's also a call to awards reps and publicists and people like that who kind of drive these engines. Like, there are, you know, there are plenty who are supporting these smaller movies that really need that push, but they require some courage on their part to say, like, hey, we can really give Idris Elba and The Harder They Fall a bigger push, like, alongside everyone else from these larger contenders. You kind of need to push that forward harder to get the Academy to pay attention. Mm-hmm. And one last thing before we share the interview with Billie Eilish and Phineas. Speaking of Idris Elba, The Hollywood Issue is out now. As you listen to this, you can see all of the different covers featuring a huge range of big stars from the year, including a lot of Oscar nominees. We're very proud of that because, you know, you have to book these covers well in advance of the Oscar nominations. And a lot of people on the cover did get nominated, including Penelope Cruz, Andrew Garfield, Kristen Stewart. I have a hard time picking a favorite of these different covers. I really love how bold and adventurous they are once again. I think Andrew Garfield's might edge it out for me for just the acrobatic pose he's got there. What do you guys think? What's your favorite from these Hollywood Issue covers?
I think Rebecca and I are going to be biased because we each run.
Well, fine. Just log roll for your cover.
Okay. My favorite is the Benedict Cumberbatch cover, which I did have the pleasure of writing. But it's Swan, it's got swans and wet shirts and everything you could ever want.
And I wrote the Idris Elba cover, which I love because he's sitting in a car swimming pool, I guess, and looks fabulous. But I am personally obsessed with the Nicole Kidman cover. I mean, I want to just blow it up and stare at her perfection every day as I, you know, wake up and I'm brushing my teeth or something. She looks phenomenal.
Yeah,
I think it's fascinating because I didn't know this. I thought I knew a lot about Kristen Stewart, but she owns the highest diving board in Los Angeles. It towers over the downtown skyline.
Yeah, it's on top of the Academy Museum, right?
Yeah. You can dive off it. It'll be your last visit to the Academy Museum. But yeah, and I think also the MJ Rodriguez cover with the tiger is so cool. And it's just a really nice mix of imagery and talent from TV and film and smaller films and bigger films. And it's fun. It's different because it's not a combined cover. It's several different covers. But I think I like that difference. It's interesting.
Yeah. And shout out also, maybe I just have a fondness for pink suits, but Simu Liu, I like Andrew Garfield wearing a pink suit and leaping over a crossing sign with the Hollywood sign in the background. It's really wonderful. He's a marvel to look at.
Pun intended.
God, it really wasn't. So the Hollywood Issue is on stands now. The articles will be rolling out over time, including some of them online already, like the Lord of the Rings a preview from Amazon. So check it out. It's our favorite time of year.
Mm-hmm. You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
So I'm now here with Sinead Burke, who, first of all, Sinead, thank you for joining me now and for the interview that we're about to listen to.
This is such a treat, Katie. Thank you for having me involved in this process and to get to talk to you and Billy and everybody else and Phineas, yeah, too.
Yeah. Well, you are the first guest interviewer I think we've ever had on the podcast who is not working for Vanity Fair. But that's for a very good reason, because I had listened to your podcast. I'd, you know, paid attention to your work and your ability to interview people and to talk about yourself, but to use that to the power of making it a better interview, I was so taken by. So I've been so excited to find, you know, we've been talking a while about having you interview somebody. And then when this opportunity came up, it seemed perfect. So maybe before we even get to the interview, can you introduce yourself and your work that isn't podcast interviews to people who are listening?
Sure. My name is Sinead, and I am an educator, a writer, an activist, and I lead a consultancy company called Tilting the Lens, which is all about rethinking accessibility through design, which is probably why I had so much fun in this conversation, because so much of my work and my interests are rooted in design, be that fashion and architecture and kind of music, and getting to talk to Billy and Phineas about their connections to those things through their own lived experiences and multiple identities was just such a treat for me to be part of. So I hope it's the same for people to listen to or read the transcript about.
Yeah, and you had met Billy previously at a fashion event, so you kind of already had a connection built there on being interested in fashion. And I think both of you approach fashion in a way of expression and accessibility, then it's different from how many people would think of the fashion industry.
Not to compare myself to Billie Eilish, because that would be quite audacious, but I think we both see fashion as a tool because of the visibility that we hold in the world. Hers because she is Billie Eilish, and mine because as a physically disabled person, fashion is a tool for me to communicate who I am. But fashion hasn't always been inclusive or welcoming to disabled people and to people like me. And I think Billy in this conversation, and Phineas in some ways too, talks about his own experiences of clothes and fashion in that way. I think we were able to connect on that level, despite our lives being very, very different.
Yeah. I think my favorite part of this interview we're about to hear is when you asked them what example they want to set for each other. I thought that they really paused and took that in as a question. Is there anything that especially stands out for you? It's been several weeks since you did the interview. Anything that has stuck with you especially?
I'm still thinking about Phineas saying to Billy that he wants to set a good example for her in how she should expect to be treated by others. Mm-hmm. I'm the eldest sibling, and it really spoke to me in terms of how I want my brothers and sisters, but also my friends, to exist in the world. And we don't always have the privilege, or we don't always have the space to be able to set that good example. It's not always within our control. But I just thought it was a very human moment for a brother and sister who, I don't know, have such space and currency in the world, that actually to see that moment of intimacy and vulnerability between just a brother and sister was really beautiful to behold.
And it makes you think about the value of being as famous as they are and having each other, that they have leaned so much on each other through this incredible rise to fame that Billy in particular has had. And I felt like that was a real glimpse into why they stick together and why they need each other so much.
And the importance of that. And I don't think Billy could be Billy without Phineas, and Phineas couldn't be himself without Billy, despite them both doing kind of separate things in different ways. But I think they are kind of the spinal cord of each other's success, not necessarily in terms of how many records they sell, but just emotionally, socially, who they are as people and who they've had to become in such an international spotlight.
Well, you spoke to them because they're nominated for the song From No Time to Die. What are you hoping to see them wear to the Oscars?
Oh, something unpredictable, I think. You know, Phineas talked about being quite predictable in his day-to-day choices, and something that he doesn't give much consideration to, but did very kindly credit his stylist. So I'm interested to see what that partnership brings. And I think what we've seen from Billie in the past 2 years is a real evolution as she has kind of matured and aged herself. And I think for them, as a gift, I just want them to be comfortable. That moment must be so terrifying. Oh, and fashion can be armor, but it can also be deeply uncomfortable. And I think for me, I always feel my best when I'm wearing something that fits, where I'm wearing something that I feel great and kind of gives me more confidence than I have. So yeah, comfort. But I don't know, maybe pajamas after a pandemic is a bit much for a red carpet. I don't know.
Silk, the finest silk pajamas might be the way to go. Well, Sinead, let's listen to your conversation with Billie Eilish and Phineas.
For accessibility reasons, I kind of wanted to kick off this conversation with a visual description. So for the audience to be aware of what that visual description is. So a visual description is something that is often used for those who are blind or low vision to give people descriptions and for it to be an experience for them too in participating in an audio format. So I'm going to kick off. To visually describe myself, I am a white cisgendered woman who uses the pronouns she and her. I have brown hair that's usually kind of just below my ear, but thanks to the pandemic, is at my shoulder length. And I am wearing a white t-shirt and a brown kind of knitted vest. And I'm sitting in front of green floral wallpaper at my home here in Ireland. But I want to hand it over to both of you, Billie and Phineas. Who wants to go first and visually describe themselves?
Girl, you're wearing a Gucci vest. It's not just a vest, it's a Gucci vest. I am Billie. I have also kind of shoulder length brown hair. Dark brown hair, kind of red-ish, supposed to be red. My hair is kind of half up in like a little ponytail on the top of my head, and I have bangs, and my eyes are blue, and I am wearing some necklaces and some jewelry, and I'm sitting on a kind of beige pink.
It's not beige, it's rust colored.
Okay, rust colored velvet couch next to my brother Phineas.
My name is Phineas. I am 24 years old. I'm also a cisgendered male. I identify as he, him. I have sort of shoulder length hair that I've been growing out for a while. It's my natural color, which is kind of a reddish, brownish blonde. And I haven't shaved my face in about a week. So I have like a kind of a beard. And
what are you wearing, Phineas?
I'm wearing these jeans that my girlfriend swears are mine that I've never ever seen before, and she was like, these are yours.
whose ex-boyfriend
I was like,
are
whose
they?
Boyfriend are these? And I'm wearing a shirt that she got me for Christmas.
A little beard, a little ponytail, and everybody with shoulder length hair. I think it's great when a visual description comes together like that.
And neither of us are in Gucci.
No, you need to be. But kind of speaking of Gucci, you know, we first met at the Gucci Love Parade fashion show, and I think at LACMA too in Los Angeles. And for me, fashion has always been a very powerful tool. It has given me, I suppose, a vehicle by which to explain who I am to the world, because people are often curious because of what I look like, because of being disabled. But I'm conscious that fashion and music are sensory tools. You know, one touches our skin and the other can uproot memories. It can even create them. And I wonder, you know, in a personal and professional context, how do you both utilize the tools of kind of fashion and music for your own satisfaction initially, but then also to obtain or to maintain power?
Well, for me, fashion has really, since I can really remember, been my kind of expressing tool and how I convey my feelings and how I feel about myself and my mood and all of the above. And it's really like a security blanket for me, and always has been since literally I can't even remember when it wasn't. And I have this like feeling that I've had for many years, is kind of this thing about myself where looking back at myself in the past, no matter how weird I thought I dressed or looked or, you know, did this or that, as long as I was being genuine and that's really what I was wanting to wear at the time, like, I'm always going to look at that and be proud of myself for doing that. You know, I would say that when I was like 15 and 16, when I knew that what I was wearing was exactly how I wanted to present myself and be seen and identify as. And no matter how crazy it looks to me now, I will always respect that girl, you know, and respect that feeling of power, and this is what I'm presenting myself as, and that's it, period, you know? So fashion is really a communication tool for me, and always depicts how I feel and what I how I look and move and how I talk. And it makes me different. And if I feel uncomfortable in something that I'm wearing, it just don't feel like myself, and I feel like a fraud, and I feel angry, and I feel overstimulated. And, you know, it's interesting. It's interesting how fashion has always made me or broke me, you know?
And that idea that your aesthetic can evolve, you know, I think we've all had questionable outfits as teenagers. And as you said, that was an accurate reflection of who we were, what we were feeling in that moment. But how we want to portray ourselves, how comfortable we feel with that portrayal, can evolve over time. I imagine much like music. Phineas, I'm not sure if you want to take the fashion angle or the music angle, but how do you find kind of satisfaction and agency in those two?
Good question. I mean, I will happily cop to being a much less innovative style-wise than Billy is. I feel that Billy is, you know, pushes boundaries and wears things that are unexpected. And sometimes we'll be in a venue where the green rooms are maybe up on the third floor of the building or something, and I'll look outside and I'll see the line of kids. And oftentimes it's kids dressed the way Billy would 6 months ago. Like, that's sort of what I'll say. And, you know, that's a testament to how sort of fashion forward Billy is. And I think that the clothing that I've always felt my most comfortable in is clothing that has a kind of a sort of a timelessness to it. And I try to kind of have the same approach to music. I remember seeing, I think it's a Butch Walker quote, where he said, "When I look back at photos, the stuff I never regret wearing is jeans and t-shirts." And I definitely feel that way. If I, like, the coolest jacket I own, 2 years later, I look back and I think, what was I thinking wearing that jacket? And something very simple, I look back on and I think, yeah, I like the way that that has aged. And so I find that that approach helps keep me feeling really happy with what I wear. And, you know, I also defer to, I have a stylist I love named Anton, who I've worked with for a couple of years. And I think he has great taste and I trust him a lot. And I show him pictures of what I like. And, you know, so to me, it's sort of a collaborative effort. And I would say more than anything, you know, I identify as a musician. And that's just really core to my self-concept. And, you know, I feel like my identity is so interwoven with, you know, writing songs and playing instruments. And it's just the thing I love to do. And I sit at home and play piano all day, regardless of, you know, what's going on, you know, with my schedule. There's sort of no, there's no facade there. It's just what I love to do.
And the two creative pursuits come together. And it's interesting what you both said about fashion. I have dwarfism, so I stand at the height of 3 feet 5 inches tall. And I've spent most of my life kind of having the only options but to shop in a children's wear department, which I was so satisfied with at the time. But it often felt like I wasn't able to represent myself to the world in the way in which I could if I had that choice. And so much of my advocacy within the fashion system is rooted in that realization that fashion can be this powerful tool to give us comfort, but to also be a vehicle for communication to everybody else. And whether that's about we want people to stay away or to come close to us or to get to know us or to give them an impression of them. And now being in that space where fashion is changing and giving that power to so many more, there's still many more who need to be accommodated. But for me, it's such a powerful tool in explaining who I am to the world and giving me confidence and space to rest. But I want to talk about kind of that visibility piece for a second, because to link those two notes, you know, as a disabled woman, I have lived a life of intense visibility. Most often kind of that visibility that's out of my control, because being a little person, people's observations of me is rarely positive. And I think at times as an adult, I've struggled to have agency over that visibility. But like what we were saying, through fashion and therapy and family and friends, I've kind of grown more comfortable with that visibility and being a kind of public person who isn't really a public person. I'm kind of more at ease with other people's interest or curiosity. But I'm conscious that you too are very visible people. How do you find agency in your visibility?
Gosh. It's hard. It's really, I mean, of course you can understand this, that it's hard to have eyes out of your control, and kind of no matter what you do and how anonymous you would like to be, you can't be. And that sucks. And, you know, it also gives you attention, which a lot of people want, you know, and people crave attention. And so they kind of go, well, you should be grateful that you have attention and you have these people looking at you. But, you know, we don't really want that all the time. It's not really, you know, we want to have a sense of anonymity and freedom and, you know, space to make mistakes and to do stupid things and, like, be a person. But, you know, I think you just take the good with the bad and you just pick your battles and go, like, what is worth me complaining about, you know? Like, I have so many things that are amazing that I get to do and get to have that I think that it's okay for me and it's valid for me to feel bad about a lot of the things in my life, but I also know that those are maybe things I talk to my own friends and family and therapists about instead of telling the whole world that might not have as much as me. And I think that it's really just about, like, knowing the privilege that you have and, like, not shitting all over it and being like, well, oh, my life's so hard because da, da, da. It's like, well, but it's actually not. And and you get to do all of these really cool things. So I try to complain as little as possible, but also be really honest, because I think that's another side of it, which is kind of the opposite side of this kind of industry. And I, you know, growing up as a fan and seeing celebrities and people in the public eye talk, I just always felt like everyone was bullshitting and I felt like people weren't telling the truth. And now that I'm in the industry, I know that people aren't telling the truth almost 95% of the time. And so since I've started, I kind of made it a rule in my own mind of kind of trying to be honest as much as I can. And the more eyes that are on me, the less honest I could actually be, which is really interesting to be learning. It's actually really weird because I did grow up as a real, like, fan, like the way that my fans are fans. And I
really grew up as a super fan, like, I would actually argue.
Yeah. And I know how they think, and I know that I constantly would be like, why can't my favorite artist just do this? And, like, why can't they just do this? And it would be so cool if they could just do this. And it's so funny because I see my fans say things just like that. And it's interesting to now know why those artists couldn't do those things, because it's just unattainable. It's just not realistic. And there's so many scary parts of fame and, like, scary non-privacy problems that require a lot more, not lying, but not like being fully open and honest, which is sad, because I always hoped that I would be able to be fully 100% honest and say everything I was thinking all the time. And you just can't, because it's just, there's too many people with different ideas and different brain things going on.
Yeah. No, exactly. And it's not about being deceitful, but finding ways to protect yourself within the chaos too, and having dignity and privacy for yourself, even in those kind of smaller spaces. But Phineas, how does a guy who's comfortable wearing just jeans and a t-shirt scaffold the chaos of having agency while being so visible?
Well, I mean, I think, first of all, I want to recognize the sort of difference between the visibility, you know, spectrum of my life and maybe Billy's life and your life. I think it's I wouldn't want to not recognize that at the end of the day we made decisions that led to our visibility, and yours was very much out of your control. And so I think that just sort of stacks the ease of navigating life factor in our favor. I feel that
trying to compare my life to yours at all.
No. Well,
I would say that.
But also, I chose to be on the cover of Vogue too, so I have a hand in some of this chaos.
Well, that's totally fair. You know, I think that what I am sort of always aware of is that, and I would assume that you on the cover of Vogue, you know, when someone comes up to you with recognition, right? You know, when it maybe was in your earlier life and somebody was staring at you because of dwarfism, where it's sort of objectifying you in this frustrating, narrow-minded way, they're not seeing you for you as the person. And if somebody's walking up to you and saying, I loved you, I loved that article I read, and I loved, you know, your thoughts on this thing.
It's very different.
And, you know, I think the only true button pusher for me is I don't like people showing up to my home, because they're not invited, And I don't like, I also don't like people who aren't willing to take no for an answer. I was in New York recently and was walking and somebody kind of barely knew who I was and was like,
that's crazy running, when
like,
people
running up to me and was like, you're Billy's brother, right? And I was like, yeah. And they were like, let me get a picture. And I was like, I'm sorry. And they followed me and yelled at me until I took a photo with them walking by Central Park. And it was really kind of intense because I'd said, I'm sorry, I can't right now. I can't stop right now. And they'd sort of yelled at me until I agreed,
almost every time I have, and I almost never say no because of this. Yeah. And also because I want to take pictures of people because I want to make them happy.
Yeah.
But every single time I've said, hey, maybe not right now, which is, again, almost never. But when I have done it, all I've gotten is guilt tripping and very, very rude comments and just disrespect and yelling at me. And it's actually crazy.
There are plenty of fans who are very understanding about it.
Totally.
And I think that, you know, you go, I'm really sorry. I'm oftentimes I'm late for something. I'm getting out of my car. I'm running to a meeting. I'm late. And somebody asks for a photo and I say, I'm so sorry. I can't. I'm running late. And they're sometimes very understanding. But yeah, the instances of, you know, to me, it's not disrespectful to ask somebody for a photo. I don't think. I think, you know, even if you're in the middle of a meal, it's just making a request. And if you say no, thank you, you know, that's you having agency over your situation. It's the not being listened to beyond that, right? Of like, you know, I've heard you say no. I'm not willing to take that as an answer. Come on, please.
Well, it's a cognitive dissonance piece, almost what you were speaking to earlier, Billy, you know, this notion of being a super fan growing up and the super fan not necessarily having an empathy or an understanding for the why of something not happening, for example. And, you know, I can share a little bit of an experience that I had kind of just a couple of years ago where I was walking down the street and 2 16-year-old boys walked past me. I thought nothing of it until 30 seconds later, one of them leapfrogged over me from behind, jumped from the ground over my head, all the while his friend recorded the entire instance on his phone for, you know, virality on the internet. Now, my response, because my background is as an elementary school teacher, was to go and try to go into that school and to speak to those boys and to speak to those students broadly and to educate them about the need for empathy and vulnerability and understanding different people's scenarios and positions. But I think that goal of educating people to be more empathetic about an individual's experiences, whether that is ordering at a restaurant or whether that's living in a very visibly different body, I think that's empathy we all need. But I am conscious that in terms of the conversation for this podcast, I really just want to have a quick conversation and moment to talk about the extraordinary success that you've had by being part of the Bond soundtrack. You know, I think No Time to Die is an extraordinary feat. And for me, the best Bond soundtracks are often composed and performed with kind of an intentionality of both the Bond and film audience and the franchise. The artist, and again, feel free to critique my assumptions around this, but I think the artist almost has to code switch to kind of a new vernacular or a new language musically and lyrically to kind of meet that audience who might not be familiar with their back catalogue, in the same way that they are overly familiar with kind of the film. And I just wondered, in the constructing and the performance of No Time to Die, what was the kind of methodology that you put together in bridging that gap between Billie Eilish, the Billie Eilish fandom, but then also bringing together the franchise of Bond and appealing to that audience who may be sitting in the theatre, not knowing Zanny, and yet still want to have something that has a legacy behind it?
Yeah, this was actually a big thing that we went in with to make this song, which is, it's really easy to make the same thing again when you know that you're good at it and when you know people like it. And what we really, really strived for with this song is we wanted to have it feel like me, but take nothing away from the franchise of James Bond and have it sound like me and feel like me. And so that it, because I didn't want it to be like a new, you know, completely, what the hell is Billy doing? This isn't anything like anything, you know, because that's jarring and that's kind of disappointing sometimes when people can't make something their own but new, where all they do is just, oh, it's fully different or it's fully them. So this was something we really, really really tried for.
Yeah, we weren't trying to, you know, it's funny because we only have experience making music for ourselves. You know, what we weren't trying to do was go in and reinvent the Bond theme, right? We, you know, we wanted to take part in this kind of stylistic area of music. That was what drew us to it in the first place, was how much we loved the existing Bond themes, like the Adele one and the Paul McCartney, Shirley Bassey. To me, what was then really important was not taking the Billie Eilish out of the equation, right? It's like, it has to be both. It has to be a Bond theme. I mean. It has to be a Billie Eilish song. And if you're not careful, it's only one or the other, right?
Yeah. It's really easy to do that. Cause you kind of just go as hard as you can. And that it's really hard to like do both, you know, like it's actually much harder to do both. You kind of would think that it wouldn't be, but it really is. It's so much easier to just go all or nothing, you know? And with this, we really, really strived to make sure that it was all of the Bond, that it had all the Bondness that it needed, but it also had a feeling of Billie Eilish as the artist. And yeah, I feel like we did pretty good in my opinion.
I know No Time to Die was released in February 2020, and with the pandemic and the world changing, the film itself came out a little bit later. Had you have known of that timeline, would you change No Time to Die in any way?
You know, if we were to make it now, yeah. But at the time, no. It was just what it needed to be when we made it. I mean, we were just saying this before that No Time to Die was as good as we needed it to be when we made it. And we were just saying earlier today that if they had said, you know, we don't really love this song.
You write something else?
Can you write something else more like this? Or like, this isn't whatever. We would have been like, no, we can't do that. Because we wrote the exact song that we wanted to write. And going into it, it was really scary, and we were like, I don't know what we're gonna do, and I don't want it to be bad, and blah 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 blah.
Be a little bit like if you went on a date with somebody and they said, I love the way you look, but would you try out a totally different personality?
Yeah, it's like, no,
like, this is the one we made. Sorry.
Yeah. And so, you know, if I knew that there would be this long in between making the song and it coming out, no, nothing would have changed at the time. I think that the only problem is that because I've aged from 17, from recording the song at 17 years old to now I'm 20 years old. That's a...
Yes, happy belated birthday.
Thank you. It's a really, really big difference in personality, in the way that you are. You know, I'm a very different and changed person now. And I think the only thing that bothers me is how different my voice is and how I feel like I could have sung it better now than I did then. But at the same time, it's very sweet and cute that it was in that exact time frame. And, you know, I get to hear that version of myself, you know, so that's fine to me.
Yeah. And you have to recognize also at the time that we made it, I'm sorry to cut you off, but I was going to say that at the time that we made it, it was the best she could do. You know what
that's
I mean?
That's what it's I was like, saying before.
You're like, hey, this is, you know, I recorded the take I wanted to record, and you get older and you get, you know, more practiced and you think, oh, I wish I could have another crack at it. But
I love the way it's only your brother who could say, yeah, it was the best she could do at the time. I'm not sure I would take that criticism from anybody else.
I still think it sounds perfect. It's just that I know when you're the one singing it, you always think you could do better.
Yeah.
Always. And I'm trying to get into this mentality of it doesn't have to be perfect. It just has to be done. And your done is always better than you think it is. I want to end with one last question. And for both of you to answer it. What is the impact that you wish to have on each other and on the world?
Did you say on each other? I love that question. That's never...
She's asked very good questions.
Yeah, these have been great. We do a lot of interviews.
We were literally dreading today because it's all interviews about Bond, right? And everybody asks the same goddamn questions and you're not. And I love that.
And you also drew the unlucky card. You're the last interview of our day. And so, you know, our answers by the time... If you'd asked all the same questions that the three other interviews had asked, like, we'd be giving our worst answers of the day.
Yeah.
But you've asked completely different new questions, so props to you.
But how do we want, what effect, I think that it's that our age difference and our difference that we're a boy and a girl and different and just experience different types of life, and he has male privilege and we both have white privilege, and we both share similarities in ourselves and also very, very different things. And I think that if anything, I just really want to have the impact on Phineas that of more just like awareness of other people's life situations and struggles and privileges. And yeah, I think that like just never, I feel like we both really, really hold each other accountable for things. I think that that's really good. We don't like let each other say stupid shit or no. crazy shit. You know, we really, really.
We say it, but then we call each other out.
Yeah, which I think is really good. And I think we both see each other's differences. And I think that we see each other's struggles, and like it makes us learn more about the world. I don't know. I want everything for Phineas. So I love my brother. But for the world. Gosh, yeah, I really just want people to be open-minded, really. I'm really so frequently fed up in how simple-minded everyone is, you know? And it's literally just like whatever is a trendy thing to think, everybody thinks that. And they think that's the only thing, and then there's a new thing to think. And then that's what everybody... It's just like weird to me. Like, I don't know why people can't just be open to things and differences and... I wish people would be less hateful in the world.
I think there's a fear about what we don't know, but I actually think acknowledging that we don't know what we don't know is incredibly powerful and beautiful, because it opens us up to a whole universe that we've never discovered before. And that's based on those struggles, privileges, lived experiences that different people have. And it shouldn't scare us that people are different to us. It should encourage us and excite us.
Yeah.
Very true.
Absolutely.
Phineas, what about you? What's the impact you want to have on Billy, no pressure, and on the world?
Sure. I mean, the impact I want to have on Billy, you know, I think I have a couple, and you know, these are just true. So I'll say them. You know, I want Billy to always feel safe telling me about things, you know, whatever they might be. I want her to feel that I'm a safe place to express those feelings. Especially, you know, this is an odd thing to say, but you know, it's, There is not a lot of room in the world full of tragedy and hardship for two of the luckiest young white cisgendered people to complain. There's other people's complaints are bigger and with more merit in many ways, I think. But that doesn't mean you don't have them.
That doesn't mean they're not valid.
And I want Billy to feel that she can always complain to me about something, you know, when she might not feel safe complaining to the internet. I also have had a great desire to model the treatment of a significant other for Billy. I'm only 4 years older, but I've always hoped that she sees the way that I treat the people I'm in relationships with, and that I'm treating them well and I'm respectful of them.
It's very true.
And I would never want her to think mistreatment of her is acceptable because she saw me mistreating somebody emotionally. So that's always in my mind. Not that I would ever want to mistreat anyone, but I think it's an added layer of, I want to treat this person the way that I would want anyone to treat the other people that I love, my parents, my sister, you know. So
cute.
I think that's a big part of it, you know. And it's a, you know, if I've ever seen her being mistreated in a relationship, the thing I think is, you know, you've never seen me treat anyone I'm in, you know, you've never seen me treat someone I love that way. To the world, you know, I think just using the privileges that we have, you know, for the greater good, I guess. I know that sounds sort of bold and maybe a little bit ambiguous, but, you know, we have platforms that we can use to talk about issues. We have, you know, the financial means to support causes and people who are, you know, just plainly smarter than we are and will be able to achieve more with the money that we give them than we would be able to achieve with that money. So, yeah, I mean, that's my hope for my impact on the world, is just that I can make it, you know, slightly better, or at the very least not make it any worse.
Billy and Phineas, it has been such a treat to speak with you this evening, my time, this afternoon, your time. If I think about the impact that these past 30 minutes have had on me, I'm so moved, genuinely, by the friendship that you have among siblings. I'm the eldest of five. I have three sisters and one brother. We're very close in age. And I think the impact that you've had on me is that I want to be that safe space for them. And I also want to be that place where they can kind of find joy and spontaneity too. And I'm incredibly grateful for your honesty and vulnerability in this conversation, and wish you the very best of luck as No Time to Die moves through award season. You would be incredibly deserving of any sort of accolade that may come your way. Thank you so much for your time.
What is the name of your mom, if you don't mind me asking?
Her name is Kath, K-A-T-H.
Well, happy birthday to Kath. And thank you so much for being willing to spare, you know, time out of your mom's day. I always feel very guilty doing it. We've played shows on our mom's birthday and had long flights, and I always feel kind of terrible. So thank you for being willing to take time out of your day or your mom's birthday to sit with us.
Well, we'll see you in Dublin.
Can't wait.
See ya.
That does it for this week's show. We'll be back next week. You can read so much award season coverage and everything else at vanityfair.com. You can follow us on Twitter at Little Gold Men, and on our own. I am at Katie Rich, and Richard
at Cheer Moment.
And David.
David Canfield 97.
And Rebecca.
Becca M. Ford.
You can also sign up to text with us at joinsubtext.com/littlegoldmen or text 917-746-3771. We got someone texting about listening to Richard talking about cats, you know, 2 years ago, however, pre-pandemic. And just the fact that these things are still rattling around in your head brings us all great joy. So please keep it coming. This week's episode was edited and produced by Brett Fuchs. And this week's award for the best preview of David Canfield's upcoming birthday party goes to Rebecca Ford.
Tom Holland's going to come out and dance.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
From PRX.